Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. I am one of your hosts, Sarah Bramau Ramos. I just had the real pleasure of talking with Elizabeth Cole about her new book, Railroads and the Transformation of China, which came out in 2019 with Harvard University Press. Now, this is, as you might be able to tell from the title, a book about railroads in China. It starts with the construction of railroads under semi-colonial conditions in the Qing, and it ends with mention of the recent One Belt, One Road initiative. It covers the transfer of railroad knowledge from European powers, the destruction of railroads during wartime, the militarization of railroads in the early PRC, and the changes that came during the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, and beyond. So it is certainly and wonderfully ambitious in scope. It draws on archival materials produced by railroad companies, sources from Western newspapers, personal diaries, travel literature, advertising materials, oral testimonies, and much, much more. So it is both rich and comprehensive. And this is a book that looks at the transformation of China from empire to the PRC and explains in a historically anchored and institutionally grounded way how Chinese railroads grew to be what they are today. Centralized, yet with a surprising degree of regional autonomy. And this is also a book filled with absolutely fascinating moments, from the absurdities of accounting systems and multiple accounting systems during semi-colonial conditions, to a look at how trains operate when they are run by red engineers, not very well, as it turns out. And yet, for all that it covers, this is also a tightly focused book, in large part because Elizabeth approaches the railroad throughout this work as an institution, which really brings the book together as a cohesive whole. It is also wonderfully clear and succinctly written. And if any of this piques your interest, I encourage you to seek out the book, because we really only scratch the very surface of all the examples, moments, and arguments in this intensely rich and detailed work. So with that, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Elizabeth that follows. I'm here today with Elizabeth Cole to talk about her new book, Railroads and the Transformation of China. Welcome to the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, Elizabeth, and thank you so much for taking the time out of your summer to talk today.
Thanks very much, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So let's begin with the traditional question of the podcast. Could you say a little bit about your own background, your own origin story, if you like? What brought you to the study of Chinese history? And specifically, what made you decide to write a history of railroads in China?
Yeah, so I started to study Chinese history a long time ago. I was an undergraduate in the mid 1980s. And at that time, I was just fascinated by, on the one hand, seeing this country coming out of the Mao period, all the economic reforms that were beginning to change the economy and society. And so I think while I wanted to continue being a historian, I increasingly became interested in the history of the economic institutions, the market, business institutions, entrepreneurs. And that sort of then led me to, you know, pursue a PhD. And while I've worked in the field of business and socioeconomic history for a long time, industrialization, textile industry and industrialization, I've always had an interest in business institutions. And I think the interest in railroads came from several experiences. On the one hand, I always thought that as an institution, the railroad in China was and is quite impressive. It is so large in terms of the physical expansion, the workforce, the enormous logistical challenges. And at the same time, I was also, you know, puzzled by the fact that nobody has written a sort of comprehensive history of railroads in China. And so that was basically the motivation to get involved in this project, which took a long time and was quite difficult because I was trying to cover a lot of ground. But here we are. And so that was the, you know, the origin of this project.
Great. Yeah. And you just mentioned that this book covers a lot of ground, and indeed it does. So Railroads and the Transformation of China looks at the development of railroads in China from the late 19th century to the post-Mao reform period. And it is, as you've just pointed out, the first comprehensive history in any language of railroad operation during this period. And the book itself, you know, it moves chronologically, and this, you know, allows you to chart how railroads grew and changed as, of course, China is growing and shrinking and changing, meaning that your focus on the railroads provides, in the words of the book, a lens through which to view the transformation of Chinese society and economy in the transition from empire to the People's Republic of China. But even though you're covering an incredible span of time in this book, and it is, for the most part, a very turbulent period of time, this book has a really robust anchor, not just because it's all about railroads, but because you have a unified approach in how you're looking at railroads. So here you approach railroads as institutions. So could you explain for listeners, particularly for listeners who are not business historians, what this approach means and, you know, why you chose it? Why view railroads in this way?
So, of course, there are multiple historical approaches to writing about railroads. So I should say that, first of all, I did not want to write a train spotter book. That was very important. Second, the question is, do you write a cultural history, a social history, a purely economic history of railroads? And believe me, I dabbled in a number of approaches when I began this project, because there are so many interesting aspects. I wanted to write a book that used the railroad as a lens on Chinese history, but you can do that in so many ways. And if you want to discuss the people who travel on it, who work on the railroad, the goods, the information that is being transported by railroads, you could go in so many ways. And of course, I looked around in terms of comparable studies or role models for how to write a railroad history. And so there are books like The Railroad in the Victorian Imagination, which is a fantastic cultural history. of the British rail system, or there is the Wolfgang Schivelbusch's sociological analysis and cultural analysis of train travel, etc. And there are these very informative economic economic histories of railroads in the U.S. and Europe that really very succinctly analyze what railroads contributed or not to the growth of a particular industry or economy. And so, and of course, you get a lot of good advice from different people who all want you to write their history. And after walking down a couple of dead-end alleys, I actually then had this idea that I need to write this as an institution. And here I mean the railroad as a physical institution in terms of railroad compounds, ministry, the bureaucratic apparatus, the railroad as the transportation linkages, but also the railroad as a management institution with directors, with railroad bureaus, with people at various levels, from the station master all the way down to the ticket collector. And the one unit or the one perspective where you can address these issues is the institution. And the longer I worked on the topic, that also made sense. If you look at the railroad, let's say, in the early 20th century and in the early 21st century, the railroad as an institution has survived. We still have railroad bureaus. We still have, well, I have to say the Ministry of Railroads was just abolished in 2013, but there are, you know, substitute institutions that take on these functions. But otherwise, as an institution, the railroad, I think, has really survived all these transitions from empire to republic, through the war to the PRC and into the economic reforms with surprising resilience. And so then that made sense for me to take it as a point of their departure, how people live, work in the institution of the railroad, and how the institution moves people, goods, and ideas.
Great. And I mean, as one reader, I thought it worked really well as, again, an anchor, you know, something solid to keep, you know, to hold everything together, because you do cover so much. But just picking on something that you touched on there, the idea that the railroad as an institution has, you know, has survived, even as, and as your book does, you know, cross perceived markers. So it crosses over the fall of the Qing and the transition to a socialist nation state, and yet the railroad stays. And you continually return in the book to the idea of continuity, right? That things are changing elsewhere and they have different names, but a surprising amount is staying the same. And something that you touch on in particular that stays the same is the regional autonomy of railroads. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, and I'm sure we're going to return to this, but if you could just speak a little bit about here, the continued persistence of regional autonomy throughout the period as you discuss it in the book. So what's going on there? And maybe for listeners who aren't so familiar with the field, why is this sort of significant? How does this reshape how we, you know, think about the Republican period or later periods?
Mm-hmm. So regional autonomy is an interesting aspect, because a lot of the discussion about modern Chinese history, especially Lei Qing, the Republic, all the way up to the revolution, is how fragmented was China? Did we see a real centralization under the Kuomintang during the Republican period did China as a nation state, which it became in 1911, as the Republic of China, did it become more centralized? And what happened to the autonomy or the political power of regions, provinces, etc. And so railroads, if you look across history, whether it's the US, the European countries, Japan or India, very often have been discussed as tools and vehicles to promote industrialization and the creation of the modern nation state, sort of helping to get the nation state on track. Forgive me for that pun.
There are so many. It was just there.
It was just there. And to help setting up bureaucratic structures, facilitating mobilities for education, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, this works for a certain country, but for China, it is not it's not a straightforward story. And so here's where I want to come back to the regional autonomy. So when railroads started out in the last decades in China, in the last decades of the 19th and early century, just around 1900, 1910, we do see a very small and quite fragmented line network, because the first companies were basically Sino-foreign syndicates where foreign capital financed joint ventures of the Chinese government and national consortia of Germany, Britain, Belgium, Japan, et cetera, that would build those railroads. And all these railroads, they were still very small in terms of track expansion. There was very little connectivity at the time. It was all focused in the Eastern Corridor of China. And of course, all these consortia had their own characteristics. So you would have German technical and engineering employees on the German-British Jinpu Railroad, and you would have French engineers and Belgium engineers on the French-speaking consortia's projects. And so this came, the way the system evolved, it was small, not very well connected. It had technical and linguistic characteristics. And so by the time 1911, the revolution comes around, and after that, the new Chinese Republican nation state, it really takes a while to create a central administration, to bring all this together under a central administration. And as I argue in the book, it really didn't work until sort of after 1927-28, during the Kuomintang period. So what that means is, on the one hand, you could say, well, it took a long time. The political situation with warlords and factionalism, it was so chaotic, they couldn't sort it out. But on the other hand, it also meant that it gave autonomy and quite a bit of decision-making to these railroad lines, who were now national railroad lines, but which at the same time still had quite a bit of impact and influence from foreign engineers and from the structure, how they had been set up earlier on. And in many ways, the central government at that time was quite happy because the government didn't have the manpower to, nor the engineering graduates, to really organize and control into every nook and cranny these railroad lines. And so for that reason, that was, in my interpretation, the beginning of a strong self-reliance and regional autonomy in the railroad bureaus. Now, I'm not saying that this didn't change over time in a sense. Of course, they became part of the central administration. The Ministry of Railroads was founded in 1928, and it became a very big and powerful ministry of the state. But these railroad bureaus really kept their regional identity because they also knew best about economic, logistical, physical challenges of these highly complex operations. And the railroad bureau system survived the war, the transition into the post-war period. And even today, in 2019, we have the railroad bureau system. There are a few changes in the number of the bureaus and sort of what line expansion they control. But the system still exists, even with high-speed railroads. So in that sense, regional autonomy has, to some extent, survived. And I think we can later talk about how that is sometimes good and sometimes also can pose a problem, especially if there is political chaos due to various campaigns or during the Cultural Revolution. But I want to just come back to your question, why that matters. I think if I would put this in one sentence, I want to say, yes, institution building happened in China in terms of the railroad as an institution, but there was also quite a degree of regionalism and autonomy on the ground that has persisted. And in so many ways, especially the first half of the 20th century, is a time where you see this young nation state becoming more regional and more central at the same time.
That does make sense. Yeah,
more regional in many ways, and I think you know this. Of course, it's not just the railroad the Republican nation state in many ways intensifies regional identity and autonomy, and yet at the same time we see institution building and centralization in the late 1920s and 30s and then onward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I mean, you just wonderfully set us up, really, in some ways, for the sort of the arc of the book that we're that I think we should really turn to now. And you took us through, in many ways, the first part of the book, as you were just sort of talking about, you know, that regional autonomy sort of comes in at the beginning of the railroad system in China when it's really, you know, getting started. Which takes us to chapter one of the book, Technology and Semi-Colonial Ventures. So just to summarize a little bit here, so here you look at the flow of British and German railroad technology, both technical and managerial expertise, and how it shaped the evolution of Chinese railroad companies in the late Qing. And one thing that this chapter, I think, makes very clear is that developing railroads in China was, to simplify greatly, was very difficult. but not because there was opposition to it. You actually make the case very clearly in this chapter that people responded very pragmatically to the railroad. The problem was, you know, structural, had to do with lack of educational establishments to create the kind of expertise necessary. And of course, as you put it, there were semi-colonial tensions and absurdities. But just to return to the idea of, you know, pragmatically responding to the railroads, could you just talk a little bit about this, how people responded to the railroads coming in?
Yeah, I think that is an important theme that goes throughout the book, but is especially explored in the first chapter. We often read about sort of the beginnings of Chinese railroad construction, where there are comments that Chinese population didn't quite embrace it, and often this is informed by sort of memories of attacks on tracks and telegraph stations during the Boxer Rebellion in 1900. And of course, this, and I'm not the first person to say this, this comes out of Paul Cohen's work, that these attacks were really attacks not for Luddite anti-technology reasons, but they were just attacks on symbols and representations of the foreign presence in China at the time. As I show, and this is based on internal railroad records from the construction of the Tianjin Pukou line, which are housed at the Baker Library at Harvard Business School. I just want to make a plug for this so that more people go ahead and use it, because it's a great collection. And what you see is that, first of all, people, Chinese, were not against selling their land. In fact, many were very clever and inflated land prices by claiming that they had a very large number of ancestral graves on their plots. And the whole process of letting the railroad into your daily life was, as I found, much less controversial, with Chinese being very pragmatic, very, very interested in gaining a good economic profit out of this situation, and being very rational. So this goes against, you know, any kind of cultural interpretation of technology phobia or any kind of the feng shui considerations of not wanting the railroad for fear that it would disturb the geomantic balance. Certainly, I'm not. I have to say that there were situations where Chinese, even if they did not want to sell the rail their land to the railroad, there were very severe and forceful reactions from the railroad company. But the only case where I could really find that was in Jiaozhou, the leased territory under the Germans, which was a colonial arrangement. And we have to remind ourselves that most of the railroad, of the Chinese railroad construction, really happened in just semi-colonial conditions where you do not have a foreign military being involved. And so what I show is that people, especially upper class Chinese, were buying up land. If they knew the line would go through, that would inflate prices. I mean, what you see with railroad construction all over the world, a lot of people made a lot of good money. And I also found, and this is really interesting, petitions by merchants to have railroads go through their county town, to have a link to the main line, because they absolutely realized the potential of the railroad for economic and social development. So all this is to say people were much more savvy and pragmatic than we give the Chinese population credit for.
Great. And I mean, absolutely, as you just pointed out, who doesn't want to get a good price for them?
Yeah.
I think that's, not everything is universal, but.
No, who, absolutely.
Who doesn't want a good price for their land?
Exactly.
Great, thank you. And pragmatism aside, going back to the establishment of railroads and how difficult it was, things don't get any easier in chapter two. As we move yeah. there, managing transitions in the early republic. So this chapter, moves us beyond the 1911 revolution, which for the railroads at least meant the nationalization of railroads. And you point out, however, that although the goal was to establish a highly effective national rail bureaucracy, there were continued problems in doing so. Mm-hmm. And you touched on this a little bit right at the beginning of our conversation when you sort of laid out what goes on in the period. But to return just to this a little bit, could you talk about the desire for centralization being strong, yet the railroad lines remaining autonomous? So why does that recur here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so after 1911, we see the nationalization of the Chinese railroad system. What that means is that in terms of sovereignty, the railroads now are under Chinese control, but they're still financed by foreign capital, and China still continues to service the bonds. Yet, at the same time, railroads are just one part of the big nation-building project that China undergoes now. That means with the creation of the republic, now we see the nation-state building through the creation of a bureaucracy for infrastructure, for education and new forms of university and training and schools, a change in the judicial system, et cetera, et cetera. So all these parts that you would expect from any process that a country has to go through when it becomes a modern nation. So while this does not lead to major changes in the railroads, how they are managed, because a lot of these contracts that the consortia had closed was one of the main requirements was that there had to be a certain number of foreign experts, of accountants or directors in particular situations. And so these foreign employees actually continued way into the 1910s and even the 1920s, something that I was very surprised by, because I thought, well, after 1911, it is sort of a much more an immediate change to just Chinese personnel. But this makes actually pretty much sense. On the one hand, you have these contractual obligations. But what we also need to know is that there was just not enough trained and professionally educated engineering and technical personnel around in China at that time. Because one of what I show is that the development of the railroads happens at the same time parallel to the development of the modern education sector. So only in the mid and late 1910s do we actually have the first graduates from engineering classes at universities and technical colleges. So there's a certain lag, time lag, of expertise. And so centralization, of course, then is much easier and much more successfully carried out once you begin to have Chinese graduates from schools that now teach railroad engineering, technical drawing, accounting, railroad accounting, et cetera, et cetera. And that happens from around, well, 1918 onward. So that is the reason why, you know, it takes quite a while for centralization really to happen, because you need, apart from the hardware, you also need the software. And, you know, this is basically happening in tandem at the same time. And we'll probably come back to this later. I would say that the contribution of the railroad to education in China is really phenomenal, because on the one hand, it became a conduit for introducing and promoting technical engineering education, the profession of an engineer. That was something really new. And that had to evolve. And it also contributed to education by creating mobility, that people could take the train, especially women, to go to school and college in larger cities like Shanghai. And railroads had kindergartens, primary schools on their railroad compounds. So this is a process that happens during the time. And because you were interested in this concept of centralization, so by the time in 1927, 1928, when we have the beginning of the Nanjing decade under the Kuomintang Party and Chiang Kai-shek, then we have a political unity or centralization in a sense that we have a much more stable political situation, and the warlord attacks and damage to tracks that has stopped. But at the same time, now we have people as graduates coming out of universities and engineering schools, and they go into the Chinese railroad administration and into the railroad bureaus. So now you can actually really build and sort of solidify this system.
Wonderful. Thank you. And you just mentioned that, you know, we're going to return to the engineers, and we will in Chapter 5. But before we get there, of course, we have Chapters 3 and 4, which make up Part 2 of the book, which is the part is Railroads and the Market and Social Space. Now, these are very, very rich chapters, and you tease out points in both of these chapters that are of particular interest, I think, with those who are familiar with the history of railroads in Great Britain or in the US. But in the interest of time, I'm just going to briefly sort of summarize these chapters so we can then, you know, carry on with the engineers. So chapter 3 discusses the economic role of the railroad, and you show that the economic impact of the railroads was actually felt most in the agricultural sector, rather, you know, unlike railroads in other parts of the world, as railroads in China offered rapid transportation for bulk agricultural commodities to reach new markets. And here you look in particular at how freight businesses developed and operated. Chapter 4 then looks at passenger transportation during the Republic. But here, too, of course, you're keeping the institutional focus and you look at how companies experienced and shaped passenger experiences. And you point out that although railroads did not foster a strong sense of national belonging, again, unlike in other parts of the world, the railroad as a business and administrative unit did bring in new disciplines, including timekeeping and standards of personal behavior. So one of my favorite parts of this chapter in particular is when you talk about textbooks published for primary students, which featured lessons on the use of clocks and watches, and also how to behave at railroad stations, which I think sounds like a great lesson. Great lesson plan there. But continuing to talk about education, we move into part 3 of the book and into chapter 5, professionalizing and politicizing the railroads. And this is, again, another very rich chapter that covers a lot of ground. So much of this looks at engineering graduates, of which there were an increasing number, and where they ended up. And you show that because Chinese rail lines in the 1920s and the 1930s were not expanding, at least not, you know, not enough to absorb all these new graduates, many of these engineers ended up in the government bureaucracy. And you also touch on how engineering became a real profession during this period, one with its own set of precepts for governing behavior and, you know, moral doctrines that engineers wanted to live up to. Here as well, you talk about, you know, less educated workers, so unskilled workers here too. But is there anything that you really wanted to point out in this chapter for listeners?
Yeah, I think especially with regard to education and expertise and knowledge, what I would like to point out that is the fact that during the Republican period, during the Kuomintang period in particular, we see the beginning of the making of the engineering state that carries over into the Mao period after 1949, in a sense that, you know, this new profession, the increasing numbers of graduates who now did not need to go to Japan any longer or did not need to go to study in Britain or the US for their first degrees. A lot of them still went for, you know, higher degrees or did even sort of work study programs to get experience as apprentices in overseas operations. But now, this enormous potential of human, very talented and skilled human resources became really the backbone of the bureaucracy during the Kuomintang period. And as you just mentioned, I think what is interesting is that the development of the job market had a lot to do with it. There was actually very little railroad building going on in the 1930s because it took a while to repair the system from the damage caused by warlords. And so by the time in, around 1930, 1931, you actually have more graduates than free positions in the actual railroad system. So what happens is that so many of these very well-educated graduates move into the ministry, and not just the ministry of railroads, but into the ministry of finance, into other bureaucratic high-level institutions. And of course, that in some ways strengthens the level of technocratic and bureaucratic knowledge, but also is helpful in terms of building the Kuomintang state, because these are, you know, all white collar, very well-educated members who are whose political agendas quite, you know, very much align with the Kuomintang. And we should also say the Kuomintang is very active. It has special branches on all the major railroad compounds. And so there is a co-option of this technocratic elite that happens in tandem with making use of their special knowledge and expertise. And I think this is interesting when we, you know, talk about post-war China and sort of the rise of the red engineers and the engineering state. I mean, Bill Kirby, Joel Andreas, and a number of other people have written and discussed this. And I think that here we see through the institution of the railroad very concrete examples. And if I sort of may already make a point that pertains to the next chapter, I think this explains why the railroad as an institution is relatively successful in the transition from the republic to the socialist system. Because what we see in the republic is a great emphasis and valuation of discipline, technical expertise, punctuality, a very strong worth ethic, you know, expertise, skills. And these were considered the values of the engineer, of making the Republican nation state work and make it stronger. And of course, after 1949, these values become socialist values to make this new socialist state stronger, to contribute to building the People's Republic under Mao Zedong. And so you didn't have to change very much in terms of the value system and the underlying work ethic and appreciation of the expertise. However, I mean, all this gets thrown overboard during the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, never mind, but certainly not in the 1950s.
Absolutely. Things will be thrown out, but not yet. Not yet.
Yes.
Not where we are. Thank you. It's yeah, that was very there's some contenders, but I love Chapter 5. But moving to Chapter 6, crisis management, here you look at the impact of war on the Chinese railroad system. And you talk about railroads as economic lifelines, about how railroads served in wartime as transportation for refugees, and about how, despite all the real damage done to, you know, railroad lines and infrastructure during this period, railroads still provided a considerable amount of mobility. And you also look here at railroad compounds that fell under Japanese management in occupied China. And I was hoping that you might talk a little bit about this part of the chapter in particular, because you're drawing, as far as I could tell, quite a lot from testimony, from oral history interviews to look at shop floor hierarchies, hiring practices, and, you know, general social dynamics under Japanese management, which I found fascinating. And we haven't talked about the sources that you use in this book. And there are, you know, many different kinds. This is not, you already made a plug for one collection. So you, you know, you draw on archival sources, you're drawing on all kinds of different pieces, textbooks we've already touched on a little bit, and oral history does come into play in chapter 7 and 8 as well, but it sort of makes its real appearance here. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about those interviews and what they revealed to you about Japanese railroad management.
Yeah, thank you. This is actually, I love talking about this because that was an exciting part of the research. So I was really intent on finding some former railroad workers to find out, what life was really like for them during the war. And of course, when I did these interviews, I mean, the gentlemen I interviewed were all in their late 70s, early and mid 80s. So we are talking about, you know, a time where they could go back in their memories to being apprentices in the late 30s and 40s under the Japanese who occupied the Tianjin-Pukou line. That was a really important line for them because it kept the goods and army transports from Shanghai up into the north, kept those transportation going. It was very important for the war effort. And it took a while to get permission to do these interviews. I point this out in the book. So it is not easy to do work with on railroads in China because railroads and the Ministry of Railroads today, after 1949, are considered part of the national defense. And that, of course, limits so much. So railroad bureaus would not let you see their archives. And believe me, I've worked on this. I've even given talks and had party secretary of the Shandong Academy of Social Sciences put in a good word for me, but couldn't get in, and so couldn't Chinese colleagues. So that's pretty much off, you know, off limits. Finally, we were, you know, I was able to do these interviews, and I think what these interviews, as well as the one for more sort of post-war issues, showed me is the enormous pride and professional, strong professional identity of railroad workers, the pride in their work, in what the railroad stands for as a very well-organized and strong institution. I saw that through all these interviews. And again, that's not surprising. That's something that you would see in other railroad contexts, national railroad contexts as well. But it was very funny. Of course, at the end of one of the interview sessions, the oldest gentleman got up and said, "Well, so now we've talked about all, you know, the history. What about our pensions? You know, could we?" And you know, the officials attending the session looked very uncomfortable and said, "Well, tea break, you know,
any opportunity."
Exactly. Which you know, is also an interesting indicator that the railroad was, after the Bank of China, the most prestigious and most sought after place to work, because you had good work conditions, very good comparatively social services. Also, your food supply was in the cities often better during hard times because of of the transportation connection, and you were entitled to free tickets. And I think this kind of higher status and recognition that has decreased sort of over time. And certainly now there is more of a marketplace, and especially sort of railroad, you know, workers in work units. In the you know, early 2000s, they were certainly not very happy with their, you know, pension payments and reorganization plans. So that, you know, offered me also a little glimpse into more contemporary developments.
That's fascinating. And yeah, I hope that tea break went well for him, that particular gentleman.
Well, the good thing is, you know, these were all mm-hmm. heroes, and had, you know, heroes in a sense that they, first of all, they were very old and respected, and they had sort of a lot of chutzpah, you know, we don't care, we want to say what we want to say. And so I can assure everybody, nobody got into trouble.
Amazing. Thank you so much. So moving into more contemporary issues, into the final section of the book, chapters 7 and 8, here, and you sort of flagged these chapters right at the beginning of our conversation, because, you know, this is where we sort of see things really change and some things really stay the same, if you like. So chapter 7, post-war reorganization and expansion, looks at the immediate changes that came in after 1949. And chapter 8, permanent revolution and continuous reform, here come the changes, looks first at how the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution forced changes on China's railroads. And then it turns to look at the period of reform following Mao's death in 1976. Now, we're coming to the end of our conversation here, so I wonder if we could sort of take on these chapters as a whole, because both of these chapters touch on the continuation of first, you know, pre-war and then pre-PRC aspect of railroad management, operation, and ideology. So you've actually touched on this a little bit. So for example, in terms of ideology, you see, you know, values like discipline and punctuality and timekeeping switch from being, you know, Republican Western modernity markers to being, you know, the goals of revolutionary socialism. And as you mentioned right at the beginning of our conversation, that, you know, some things stay the same for better or for worse. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this, what, you know, what made it for better or for worse into this period.
Yeah. So I think in terms of continuation, after 1949 and the founding of the People's Republic, so what we see is sort of a regrouping and re-centralization of the railroad bureaus under the railroad administration, the Ministry of railroads. And I think that takes a bit of time, because we have to remember it means integrating Manchuria, which was before under Japanese control, into the system. Then, you know, Taiwan was in during the Civil War, now it's out again from the network. So that happens along with a new move, and that is to militarize the construction arm of the railroad network. And we have this introduction of the Qiedao Bing, the railroad construction workers, who are part of the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, and who are now sent to construct the new lines that begin to being built in central China, in the northwest, in the south, because this is now the time where we see the Chinese the Chinese New Socialist State, the PRC, pushing railroad construction very concisely with a lot of manpower in particular, and of course mobilizing this new unit in the army means that you have full control, and it's easier to organize. And of course, with these army workers and engineers, you also have a very disciplined and very dedicated workforce. I mean, you mentioned before that railroad construction was difficult. Well, it becomes really difficult in very unhospitable terrain in the south and southwest. And this is the time when we have numerous construction workers / soldiers dying in accidents, high altitude, mudslides, you know, explosion accidents, et cetera, et cetera. But it is for bringing the state now in every nook and cranny of the Chinese territory. And this is a process that continues pretty much from the 1950s onward. Throughout, well, we see it with the Tibetan Railroad sort of bringing this pretty much full circle by creating the link to the most Western provinces. And of course, there are great disruptions, great leap forward, Cultural Revolution. I should say that one of my major arguments, and this also goes to the point of sources, it's very difficult to get sources generated by the railroad administration or the bureaus on the chaos and negative impact of these campaigns. But what you can get, if you know where to look, is accident statistics. And I make a point of looking, and I show how, especially during the Great Leap Forward and during the Cultural Revolution, accident statistics spike because the system is now not run by experts, but by political appointees, and by the fact that now the railroads do not run under railroad time, but under political time, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Yeah, I thought that was a really impactful part of this chapter, of chapter eight. Mm-hmm. When you talk about how, you know, what does riding the railroad look like under red engineers? Well, it looks very chaotic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mm-hmm. accidents spike, trains crashing into each other, all of that. That was sort of laid it out with regards to the sources that you couldn't access, a very a great way to sort of access that information, mm-hmm. you know, about what rail looked like during this period.
Please.
No. I mean, there is so much in these chapters and in the rest of the book as a whole that we just haven't been able to touch on here. So for any listeners who are interested in anything at all that we've covered, and this book does really cover a lot, I would encourage them to seek it out. You will be rewarded. But now that you're finished with this book, Elizabeth, what are mm-hmm. you working on next? What is inspiring you now?
Well, so currently I have two projects. So one is I want to write a history of pawn shops and pawnbroking as a source of informal finance from sort of the 18th century to the present. And well, no surprise here. I think that one of the reasons why I find this an interesting topic is that we see pawnbroking and pawn shops not only as a very important practice and institution of informal finance in China, but also pawn shops disappeared after 1945 and 49 because they were capitalist institutions, but they've come back in a slightly different and sort of more business-like form, in a sense that they provide credit for small and medium enterprises. And so I'm just interested in the question why and how these institutions continue and why they never turned into banks like in some European cases. And my other project is I would like, based on a collection of letters, diary entries, and photographs of an American salesman for British American Tobacco in China in the 1920s, I would like to write a sort of more popular small history of what it was like to do business in China as a foreigner in the 1920s in the countryside.
Oh, wow. They both sound like amazing projects. The second in particular, I can see of being a real joy to read. Pawn shops aside. They both sound like amazing projects. And I look forward to hearing and reading more about them in the future. Thank you again, Elizabeth, for writing a book that was such a pleasure to read and such a pleasure to talk about.
Well, thank you, Sarah, for, you know, your interest and also for your great questions. It has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.